Blog Talk Radio.
For the next little while, Dale Graham. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you, and particularly for the connections from overseas. Overseas, I love that. Don't you? It's the 306th day of the year, and there you have it. The rest is you make of it what you can. 2014, just incredible. I want to share a little bit of the, history that I think is noteworthy. This is kind of in a special period in time. We missed just passed a date that is significant in history, and it prompted a series of events that I think had a bearing on Freemasonry. But you decide on the conviction that Masonry had something to offer. Now, bear with me here. 1707, one of the worst maritime disasters in British history, appeared off the Isles of Scilly on this day in history. It was the 22nd of October. In the summer of 1707, Commander-in-Chief of the British fleets, Sir Cloudesley Shovel, had led a fleet of 21 British ships in their Mediterranean campaign against the French as part of the War of the Spanish Succession. At summer's end, the fleet, led by Chauvel's flagship HMS Association, departed Gibraltar on the 29th of September, bound for England. The entire return voyage was plagued by bad weather and strong gales. The portion of their journey that traversed the Atlantic saw increasingly worse weather that pushed them off course. As the fleet entered the English Channel on the night of 22nd October, the sailing masters thought they were safe in the waters west of Ushant. As it turns out, the sailing masters had miscalculated their longitude. And by the added effect of the bad weather, the fleet had actually headed on a collision course with the rocks off the islands of Scilly. Before they realized their mistake, four ships had struck the rocks and sank. HMS Association, the flagship, HMS Eagle, HMS Romney, and HMS Firebrand. That was a fire ship, huh? The sole survivor from the sinking of the three largest ships was George Lawrence, who had worked as a butcher before joining the crew of Romney as quartermaster. The unfortunate wreck resulted in an unknown number of deaths, although estimates place the number of victims between 1,400 and 2,000, including Cloudesley Shovel, making the Scilly naval disaster one of the worst maritime histories in British history, Britain's history. The part that incorrect longitudinal measurement played in the Scilly naval disaster eventually led to the Longitude Act of 1714, which established the Board of Longitude and offered a large money prize for anyone who could find a method of determining longitude accurately at sea. Now, bear with me one step. Sad time. The calculation of latitude was relatively easy compared to longitude. And because sailors knew that if you couldn't tell your longitude, you couldn't tell how far you were from known dangers in the water. And this is what happened with Chauvel's, or Chauvel's, if you want, calculations. This is the flagship of the Navy. So this had the very best sailors, navigators on board. And it couldn't avoid the rocks. Now, as a result, this contest, this open competition, declared that there needed to be a way of calculating the longitude. Now, there were, and the key to this, as you already know, is a clock that would work on the shifting surface of a deck at sea. A pendulum wouldn't work. Those had already been developed. They didn't work because although the physics of a pendulum were known, it was influenced by the sway of the ship. The spring-activated clock on its own wouldn't work because, as we know, as the spring unwinds, the tension changes, and left a irregular calculation. So it was the development of a watch that was key. And it was eventually awarded in 1765 to John Harrison for his chronometer. And this is no means the first prize to be offered to solve this problem. They had tried this before. John Harrison was by no means the first one to develop this. But I must tell you that it was with financing by a Graham, thank you very much, that allowed Harrison to submit his his invention forward. And so this was the result. Now, this was happening in 1707, yeah? So I like to think that the act occurred in 1714. Now, Freemasonry, as we know it, was the footprint was 1717, circa 17, but there was a lot of activity going on with the Royal Institute and the Royal Society after that. And you wonder, the activity within the Royal Institute at that period was, and the Royal Society was markedly engaging to men, to the scientists and philosophers of the day who were Masons. Now, this is, as you know, was a carry-on of something that had happened earlier in Britain, in the culture of Britain, particularly the penny universities. I think this was significant because this is where we see a use of public space for debate, use of commercial space as a place of gathering of like-minded individuals. Now, to think that we would sit down and develop the idea of using the metaphor, the mechanics of guild, the fragmented history of the guilds left a great deal of latitude for developers of new ideas. You could be creative, and that's what the initial constitutions of Masonry have relied on, the creativity. And I'll say it out loud. It's a lot of it is genius a lot of it, if not all of it. I say a lot of it because there's parts that I haven't, it's far too vast for me to have put my attention to every single aspect. So I rely on you, you and your reading and your enthusiasm for a particular area that's outside my scope or just beyond my time frame. And we sit down and we compare notes constantly. So I think that it would be hard to believe that thoughtful men of the day wouldn't be informed about the silly naval disaster and the competition of the day to develop a watch or a clock. Now, what Harrison developed went on to be, it wasn't just a ship's clock, but it was the same mechanics that are used today in watches, in wind-up watches. So he quickly, it was miniaturized fairly quickly. And as long as you could use an accurate time, your calculation of course, sailors out there, distance and speed and time, that really gives you a pinpoint, a precise way of calculating where you are in the oceans. Apart from just using celestial navigation. Now, I ask you, do you think that is a relevant influence? It's in the sense that it would gives this air of enthusiasm and purpose to applied science. Just like the alchemists, they were scientists doing research in their laboratories, but it's the application. We can look smugly at them and think, my goodness, what ridiculous premise that they were operating on, the lodestone. How ridiculous. Well, in the day, it wasn't. There are things that we are doing today that will, I think, in the future be apparently ridiculous. So we might want to be cautious about criticizing a process that's still with us today. The head of the UN has just declared an unequivocal outcome for the world if we do nothing about the use of fossil fuels. We still live in a time when people will stand up on their back legs and argue that this is all a very natural outcome. Well, what's natural is the sun is eventually going to burn out. Oh, excuse me, that will be about, 830 billion years from now. So we better best prepare for that. Well, the smug amongst us might be thinking that we're going to be around then, but if we pay careful attention to the science, the scientists, the people that we charge with the notion of making observations that we need to hear are telling us that we're suffocating our world, our atmosphere. Well, gee, you and I depend very greatly on that atmosphere for our lives. And it's a careful balance. You've heard that Goldilocks notion of the planet? Not too big, not too small, not too cold, not too warm. This interesting, curious balance that allows us to exist. Does it matter to you that of all the oxygen that you take in, 85% of it is used to create brain function? Does that matter? So eat, don't exercise, don't care about your diet. Smoke, clog up those little membranes, because really the science is telling us that it does matter. But if you come from a day where you can justify yourself through ignorance, the ignorance is bliss. Well, it's not. Ignorance is when we don't know something. When we do know something and we ignore it, that's called stupidity. So often I've heard you say that there's no way that we can, we can do a lot, but we can't make a law that outlaws, that stops stupidity. Well, there is an end to stupidity. And don't think it's apocalyptic. This is coming gradually. There's no crisis. The stupidity has always been around us. This will take the some commitment to support the enlightened and best minds that there are on the face of the earth. But we tend not to do that. We can take the creation of a source of remarkable energy and weaponize it. So we're still having at it. And our behavior suggests that we will continue. I see no reason. And I resent it. You know, I take offense if somebody says, oh, I'm being pessimistic. I'm trying to be realistic here. In the meantime, the question is, how do we live? We live optimistically. We live hopefully. We aspire to correcting these problems and issues through awareness. But there comes a time when we will have to make some decisions. And then when that time comes, we will be acting in unison. We will, and this isn't the waiting for the apocalypse, waiting for bad things to happen, and then saying, oh, well, we should have done something years ago about the stupidity. Well, our nature is when large things happen, we do correct the stupidity. Our efforts to look at, we have to be conscious that there is threat and there's diabolical and unpleasant and evil people around us all the time. But it doesn't mean we have to be bunkered into our basements with the weapons pointed at our neighbors. This is, after all, a country based on some enlightened ideas with a constitution that is still criticized by some. That happens to be one of the most progressive in the face of the earth. Oh, we might not like the fact that you and I might have issue with a particular element of rights. Why is that person having rights? Well, that's the nature of an enlightened society. And that's what we happen to be in. And it challenges us. It challenges our own shortcomings. So I want to ask you to think about that. Just as we would think about the effects of the greatness of science, brings together people from different walks of life, from different status, but it always depends on people making observations. I'll give you an example here. You've heard of Isaac Newton, considered by some the greatest scientist. But Isaac Newton looked at an apple falling. Now, we claim that he discovered gravity in that act. Really? Discovered gravity in that act? What he did was he asked, how does the apple know to fall? Like, what are the properties? Well, we find that that question lingered. And as it lingered, there was a young fellow that was living with his mother in London, single parent, a very, very poor family, with his younger brother. And this was a particularly bright young man. And when he could, he was hired to do menial work and cleaning at the Royal Institute. And at night, instead of running home, he would read. He had actually started off working in a print shop. And every time there was a book printed, he would read. And he was self-taught. Then, because he was self-taught, he presented a paper on an explanation of some work one of the greatest scientists of the day. Now, the explanation was in itself remarkable. So the scientist brought him into his office and offered him a menial job, cleaning the labs and running some of the experiments under the instruction of the scientist. Now, eventually the scientist died. The scientist gave this young fellow, his name was Michael Lafferty, gave him very menial tasks to do, because he realized that we think in hindsight that he realized that this young man was exceptionally bright and could be a threat if he had developed ideas that were out beyond the scope of what the renowned scientist was doing. So he even took him away from some of his work with chemistry and asked him to look at the properties the Italians had created in developing pure glass, and to do it in reverse. Take some of the glass that they had created, break it down into its components, learn what those components are. Well, Lafferty worked for 7 years on this task, and he couldn't. He couldn't figure out what it took to create the purity of glass. Most of the glass up until that point had been a bit opaque. So he ended up in failure. He just could not do it. He was very discouraged, but he was also wanting to get back to the lab. After 7 years, he kept a block of the glass. Now, the long and the short of this is that when he started to explain, he began the properties of gravity. He began by noticing the properties of electricity and the properties of magnetism. And he began as a metaphysicist to realize that there were powers and influences beyond what could be seen. You could see the result of it, like when we were boys and we took a magnet under a sheet of paper and put our filings on it, gave it a little bit of a shake, the filings would take the shape of the force, the magnetic force. He began to understand that light could be bent. And the key to doing that was that block of glass. Anyway, all of that aside, when he presented his proof, his drafts of the explanation for the magnetic properties of electricity, up until that point, electricity had only been a novelty. And what Lafferty discovered was that it could be harnessed into energy, into a mechanical machine. Now, that meant we could create machines that could do things for us. And that's how it started, in a laboratory. When he went to present his work to the Royal Institution, he was mocked. And this is where he was not a young man anymore. He had become quite distinguished because scientist died, he was given the role of being the coordinator of all experiments that were conducted for the Royal Institution because his work was so precise, self-taught. When he presented his work, expecting that it would be well received, he was mocked, he was laughed at, because the limit of his education came to the surface. He had not been taught mathematics. So his work sat on a shelf until this young boy named Clerk Maxwell, James Clerk Maxwell, was the only child of a fairly well-to-do family, and he was doted on. And he was very good at maths. He came across the work of Lafferty and began to study them at a very early age. And he began to understand that this had not been accepted because it was not resolved mathematically. He put his mind to resolving this, the maths. And he eventually discovered the mathematical resolution that explained how waves of light could be bent. Now, this was, at the time, incredible for a math and for the world, for us, James Clerk Maxwell. His most notable achievement was to formulate the classical theory of electromagnetic radiation. You see, this was 19th century. This was 19th century. He was a scholar and a physicist, right? And of course, he's from Edinburgh. I say that just to give you a bit of stick. But we see that the work of Isaac Newton, the observation of Newton, to ask why, how did the apple know? Why did that apple fall? Why did the idea that something was affecting that apple so that it came to the ground? Yeah. So we think that we see that the work, whether complete or not, is passed on from generation to generation. We see that the work of a great minds is passed on from generation to generation. Yeah. So when you do look at the work that we see around us, it may not be complete in our understanding, but because it's not been resolved through by our physicists and mathematicians. But it may nevertheless be offering us a piece of the larger puzzle. Today, with the access to millions of computers, our computing capability has expanded beyond anything that we could have imagined. So we're able to run trials, different formulations, at an accelerated rate. So the amount of knowledge that we are accumulating is doubling every 6 years, 7 years, sorry. Is this, in the same way that I think the influences of science were prevalent and important to early development of masonry, are the things going on around us today going to continue to have a similar effect, to take masonry as we know it to another level? I know that this will be taking things sideways from people who believe that Freemasonry today is the accumulation of history, of events that happened yesterday. I can't think of anything more interesting than to say to them, all of the things that we quote, all of the things that we study, were not known at the time to have been significant. Hindsight allows us that. When we can see the application of what Lafferty was able to work on, when we can see the resolution of the properties of electromagnetism. For the average schoolboy, this didn't matter in the 19th and 20th century. But for the schoolboy of the 21st and 22nd century, this will be remarkable and essential and eventually fully taken for granted as he moves on in his future. To think that masonry will be immune to that, I think is limiting the potential that this order was built on. The potential to not reinvent, but to be part of a stream of development, of creativity. We have been part of the philosophically creative, comprehensive notion of humanity. Not exactly what we could call insignificant. And it's been written down in so many different aspects because the laboratory, the Masonic laboratory, has millions of scientists at the table. And we're noticing things, different bits and different pieces. And we're writing down those observations. So right now, those observations may or may not be tested. We may or may not have the mathematical resolution for these observations. But in the meantime, of all of those opinions, And all of those observations, in them may rest a piece of the larger puzzle. So the way that we equip ourselves is by becoming more and more powerful through knowledge. The more we understand about the context of Masonic values and principles and the philosophy, the more powerful the statements are about the effect. We begin to realize the potential effect. Let me quote you a line from a secret passage, and out of context, it'll mean nothing. Some are Masons a mere idle curiosity, some because it may profit their business or secure them aid in disaster or help in danger. Some because of its supposed mysteries or titles or decorations or the distinction it is deemed to confer. In other words, who knows what motivates people to join this? Is it just that blank curiosity? For some, yes. I want to say optimistically, you know, I want to be popular with everybody out there and say, yeah, that's 99.9% of the time that's the case. Except I woke up from that dream. It's not the case. We don't know. We don't know what motivates. Is it profit? I hope not, because those folks will hear this, but they may not clue in that we're really talking about them. And should they leave? Well, they already are. They already are supporting this central philosophy of Freemasonry. Not a bit, rarely, but being staunch and committed, going through ritual. Some Masons value idle parade and unprofitable display. Doesn't that apply? They value it. To go through the ritual, to dress properly in a distinguished way, to actually memorize some work and be part of an interaction, a prescribed interaction, is unique in the lives of a lot of people. It's not like a team leaning over a body in a surgery. Everybody has their part to do and everybody can predict it. But then we do have a master at the head of it that is trained so that if things do not align with the way the textbook says they're supposed to align, he or she is able to make the necessary adjustments. So the function of the team is success. So you may not have had that sense of team. Some, the sense of team may have been on a sports field. And the goal was not necessarily the success of somebody else. It's victory. It's competition. What a meager sense of team. Mutual support and survival. Would that be what it will feel like to be a deckhand on a destroyer in the wars, or a gunner in an aircraft, or a navigator in those old battles that look so arcane today? Huh. Anyway, think about it. Tell me, does this have a bearing on Masonry today? Do you know what gigaws and gimcracks are? Yeah, of course you do. But I'll refresh you in case you're just slumbering a little bit. The definition of a gimcrack is a lovely old word. It's a bauble. A remarkable amount of money is spent on gimcracks and unnecessary items. It's baubles. Bubbles. Those things are called gimcracks. And gauze. You know, it's beautiful. What a great, our language is full of these wonderful old words. Give you a sense of what a gimcrack is. It's flimsy or poorly made, but it looks really attractive, you know. Like those cheap toys that you would get at the carnival when you won the ring toss. You know, you'd spend $4 winning a ring toss and get a sheriff's badge that was so flimsy it would fall apart before you got to the back seat of the car. Or today, the stuffed toy that's full of, we won't even think about what's inside that. So some cheap ornament, poorly made, gimcracks and gewgaws. Title of today, Ideas and Gimcracks, Environment Concerning Masonry. Sooner or later, it was bound to happen. The gimcracks and gewgaws, no more. So, block a stream of water, the energy and power continue to build. The effect comes to us as consequences, intended or not, up or downstream. Consequences after the fact. We should learn by those consequences, shouldn't we? You would think. And the time it takes to reckon this is time invested to replace ill-conceived ideas and to attend to the self-serving mindsets of the masses. It's very lonely. It's a very lonely experience to stand against the mainstream. Can you imagine? We'll think about some lunacy in the past of humanity. Witch hunts. There you go. There's something that was remarkably stupid. And it wasn't just women, but mostly women were killed. The women were burned alive because of superstitions that bred fear amongst zealots. Oh, the early pioneers to the United States were pilgrims and Puritans, right? And we know that the Puritans were having a hard time in Europe and Britain before they left, because they were over the top. They were severe. Do you remember the pictures that we see, this tall hat, white lace collar, and black outfit with stockings? Yeah. Compared to the styles that were going on, they dressed, they were distinctly different. And so they needed a place where they wouldn't be harassed by the existing status quo. Which they were getting. They were getting a lot of stick in Britain and Europe. Now, this is the same lot that, in their piety, decided that older women that had accumulated naturopathy, that had been taught herbal remedies, medicines, natural medicines by their mothers or grandmothers, were in some way had gained a capacity that was able to cure illness and save life. Confronting in the small minds of zealots the notion that only the Creator can do that. Well, ultimately, it is the Creator. Nobody can bring back somebody that's dying if you're so broken, no matter how much we try, how much we say. We use that in the vernacular, that they were dead and came back. Well, we don't have that power. Or we would be doing it deliberately, wouldn't we? And we can't. These things happen for reasons beyond us. But we sure took it upon ourselves, as humane people, to rid ourselves of the danger of those naturopathists, the people that knew this, these, how to pick herbs that would cure. Remember, this is we're the same bunch that came up with the notion of innocence by battle. If you won the fight, you were innocent. Innocence by water. If we attempted to drown you and you didn't drown, we tied a stone around your ankles and threw you in the river. If she didn't drown, then she was innocent. Oh, we just started joining the dots here. You're going to say, well, what's the point? Yeah, we've got it. What's the point? The point is we're capable of great things, and we're capable of some very scary things when we get together and the rhetoric gets out of control. So can you imagine that? That aside, that's nothing new. The hysteria, the stupidity of the masses. Well, we've been learning about that from our Greek historians. You know, just how stupid. It was the masses that killed Plato, wasn't it? Yeah. That's the sort of the benchmark, I guess we could say, for how stupid the masses can be. And this is not comfortable to be sitting, acting or sounding smug about it. The message here, though, is what does it feel like to stand up and advocate for that woman that's in the cage while the masses are screaming for her death? The religious authorities are giving us, or legitimizing the act, our actions, and building a pyre. And what would it feel like to stand up and declare that this act is inhumane and wrong? You and I might say to do that would be suicide, because you would likely end up in the fire yourself. And that's what kind of people we are when we get together. We have that capability. It's just the triggers. So we have to be mindful always of the triggers. Always mindful of the triggers, the cascade effect. And being silent in the background doesn't work. We give voice to our principles through our actions. That's how we make our statements, our way of thinking known. The quiet diplomacy. The quiet diplomacy. That's the best part. So think about that. Tell me what you think. Does that make any sense at all? Do you think we're influenced in these ways? I want to talk about... I want to talk to you a little bit about Freemasonry in Prince of Rhode Island, just because. Okay? Just to round this off and send us out. I think, year 1797, is that okay? Number of Masons residing on the island of St. John's. It was originally called St. John's Island. In 1798, the name was changed. That was the next year, changing it to Prince of Rhode Island. That was in honor of the Duke of Kent, by the way, who we know, resolution, ancients, moderns, Duke of Kent. Yeah. This is when the Masons petitioned the Provincial Grand Lodge of the most ancient and honorable fraternity of free and accepted Masons in the province of Nova Scotia in North America for a warrant of constitution. The petition was favorably received and a charter granted to St. John's Lodge No. 26 on the 9th day of October 1797. And it was signed by Richard Buckley, the Grand Master, Duncan Clark, the Deputy Grand Master, James Clark, the Senior Grand Warden, John Bremner, the Junior Grand Warden, and John Selby, Grand Secretary, to open a lodge at the house of Alexander Richardson or elsewhere in Charlottetown on the second Tuesday of each calendar month, and on all seasonable times and lawful occasions, appointing Ebenezer Nicholson, Worshipful Master, William Hillman, Senior Warden, and Robert Lee, the Junior Warden. The then Lieutenant Governor, Edmund Fanning, was a member of the lodge, and on the 27th of December, 1797, presented to it a copy of the Holy Bible, still part of its furniture. After the union of the two Grand Lodges in England, the lodge was given a new number, 833, and continued as the sole lodge on Prince Edward Island until 1827, when Sussex Lodge was created. It ceased work and was erased in 1837. In 1858, a new lodge, Victoria, was organized under a warrant of constitution received from the Grand Lodge of Scotland. Later, on the following lodges were erected under authority of the Grand Lodge of England: King Hiram, St. Eleanor's, 1858, St. George's in Georgetown, in 1861, and Mount Lebanon in Summerside, and Alexandra, Port Hill in 1863. Zetland in Alberton in 1867, and True Brothers in Tyrone in 1869. From 1797 to 1869, the lodges holding under authority of the Grand Lodge of England were subject to the authority of the District Deputy Grand Master of Nova Scotia. In the latter year, the lodges of Nova Scotia erected an independent Grand Lodge. The then District Deputy Grand Master, the Honorable Alexander Keith, being elected its first Grand Master. He thereby vacated the office held by him under the Grand Lodge of England, leaving the fraternity in Prince Edward Island without a provincial head or one in authority to grant dispensations when required. The matter being brought to the notice of the Grand Lodge of England, the Right Honorable, the Marquis de Ripon, Grand Master of England in January 1871, appointed Right Worshipful Adam Murray, District Deputy Grand Master of Prince Edward Island. The Grand Lodge of Prince Edward Island on the 23rd of June 1875, delegates representing the eight lodges of the province met in Charlottetown and organized the Grand Lodge of Prince Edward Island. And on St. John's Day, June 24th, the late Senator John V. Ellis, Grand Master of New Brunswick, assisted by his grand officers, installed the Honorable John Yeo as Grand Master. Royal Arch Masonry is under the grand jurisdiction of Nova Scotia. There is a Council of the Cryptic Rite under the Supreme Grand Council of the Maritimes Provinces at Kensington. The Order of the Temple was established through the efforts of the late Most Worshipful Brother R. McNeil, Prince Edward Preceptory No. 35, and was opened by Right Eminent Sir Knight J.B. Nixon of Toronto under dispensation dated the 12th of November, 1895, representing its warrant of constitution from the Grand Priory of Canada in 1896. The ancient and accepted Scottish Rite was introduced by the late illustrious Brother R. McNeil, 33rd degree. Albert Edward Lodge of Perfection was constituted by illustrious Brother J. A. Watson, 32nd degree, of St. John, New Brunswick, as special deputy. And on the 23rd day of September 1896, under dispensation granted by most illustrious Brother J. W. Merton, 33rd degree, the Grand Sovereign Grand Commander of the Supreme Council of the Ancient and Accepted Scottish Rite for the Dominion of Canada, dated the 10th of August, 1896. There you have it. There you have the Grand Lodge of the little province. Yeah. It's been an outright delight being here. So ominous things seem to be happening. There's a group of people that, a family that one of their sons is embarrassing himself, a celebrity here in Canada. I won't mention his name. I think it should be all is proved against this young man. His name will probably not be easily forgotten and not mentioned, so I'm not going to do it here. Interesting when a family has to bear the disgrace of a member. Yeah? Hopefully, and I know, and knowingly, your families will bear they may bear some criticism because you're a Mason, but they may also know that to be gentle in talking with people who are obviously not as informed as members of our families are about the things that make us a Mason. Hardly something that would make us a threat to the world, except to the a threat to the closed-minded, feeble-minded people of a political stripe that is in need of keeping people uninformed and in the dark. Certainly, that's not the way things are. Now, being a product of the 60s in some way, I just want to play you a little piece of music that I think reflects what's gone on with the head of the UN today announcing the they're starting to take a look at weaning us off fossil fuels by the end of the century. God bless them all. I hope that we achieve that goal, that the cars that we drive will go the way of the albatross, I think. And if you think that you and I are going to have to make the change, give your head a shake. One of the Masonic values is talks to us about immortality. No, you don't come back. Good God, once is enough. But there is a notion, an aspect of us that makes us immortal. And it comes about when we are loved by others and when we learn to love. Being loved by others and learning to love others makes us immortal, because that is remembered long after our death. So, strive for immortality. Check this out. I think you'll like it. And I'll see you again soon. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for supporting Masonic Home Companion.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Being drawn, nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and they're carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
With you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. The strings I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were set by the The words that it was for me, and the signs kept the words.